Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The Athletic.
Coming up, we discuss why Williams were only able to field two cars in Australia, take a closer look at whether DRS issues are holding McLaren back, and answer your tech questions on gearbox setup, DRS in the V10 era, and Mercedes' stuttering start. Welcome to another episode of the Race F1 Tech Show. I'm Ed Straw, and with me as always is Gary Anderson, who has decades of experience in motorsport, and is far more credible than me because he's been responsible for Grand Prix winning cars. So how are you doing after this weekend, Gary? I must admit, I'm slightly concerned about this podcast because you've been burning the midnight oil following goings on in Australia, and I only just landed after the long journey back from Melbourne, so who knows what the energy levels are going to be like.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit difficult whenever the time zone is so far apart. I must admit to getting up and watching qualifying and getting up and watching the race, but I did stay in bed for the practice sessions. I hate watching it recorded whenever you sort of know the result. So, yeah, for me, it's important to watch it fairly live. So I do get up and have a look at it. And yeah, it was a good race. I enjoyed it. Good to see something different happening, obviously. We always want that, see competition. And the competition was there. I don't think it was just as black and white for Red Bull this weekend as what it sort of looked like. And obviously the reliability problems that Verstappen had, you know, didn't let us see where Sainz really stood in the Ferrari. But I think he was strong. I think he would have been in there, given it a good shout come the end of the race if Verstappen hadn't had his problems.
Yeah, certainly an encouraging sign for the rest of the season. Tricky weekend tyre-wise. But yeah, I'd be interested to see how it would have played out. I certainly think it wouldn't have been an utterly straightforward Verstappen one, certainly, and perhaps a bit more difficult than that. So yeah, I'm sure we'll get a chance to see a race like that again later in the season. Some positive signs for the year, because all we really want is a good battle at the front. Now, as always, the floor's clear for you to talk about whatever you want in the first part of this podcast, provided it's at least tenuously connected to the world of F1 tech. So what's grabbed your attention lately?
Well, there's two sort of things, really. I mean, Ferrari progress, obviously, you know, they have closed the gap down, or it looks on face value like they've closed the gap down at least. You know, I think Carlos Sainz is driving with a whole new spirit. He's obviously, body-wise, is a little bit lighter since he's lost his appendix. But I'm sure that's not making too big a difference. But at the end of the day, obviously, he's fighting for his career. He needs another drive. He's not got the Ferrari drive next year. So I think he's just lifted his game that little bit just because of that. And you know, he's reaping a reward for it. He had, you know, more or less a faultless weekend as far as he was concerned. And Ferrari were able to, you know, go through the weekend without making some of the customary mistakes. So I think on the whole, Ferrari have lifted the game that little bit. But, the ones that really sort of stood out a little bit to me was the two McLarens. Obviously, they're doing a strong job as well. And again, both drivers fairly competitive with each other. But one of the things that, you know, they're definitely still struggling with is the DRS and the drag reduction that they get when the DRS is in operation. And it's one of the things that in the race will hold you back. But I think it's a bigger problem than that. If you look at it more, you know, more in detail, I suppose, you know, they talk about their car being poor in slow corners, I suppose you might call it, little less grip in slow corners, and good in the fast corners. So they're always looking forward to high-speed circuits. And that, to me, points in the direction that the car could be a problem at not making the best use of the DRS. As I've said many times in my book, the DRS is a three-element component. It's the upper rear wing that you reduce the downforce and you reduce the drag from. But the flow structure around that wing needs to connect to the beam wing, and the beam wing needs to connect to the diffuser. And basically, if you have the correct setup, you get a triple whammy. When you open the DRS up, the beam wing should stall and the diffuser will stall. But that's all dependent on how hard the diffuser and the underfloor is working before you use that DRS. So let's take an example. You know, if you've got a car that's got good downforce at low speed the car's, the ride height's high. So if you've got a car that's got good downforce when the ride height's high, then it can be a problem when the ride height's low, in other words, at high speed, because the car gets too sensitive with the normal airflow separation problems under the floor in the areas where basically you're not using the DRS. So the way the McLaren seems to me is that they don't have that separation problem on the underfloor at low ride heights, which means they have less downforce at high ride heights in the slow speed corners. But because they don't have that separation problems in the at low ride heights, when the DRS, when you open the DRS, it doesn't stall the floor either, because the floor isn't on that critical point of stalling. So it's a triple whammy, as I say. Basically, if they get the car to have more low speed, high ride height downforce, then they will have a car that's more difficult in the high speed, low ride height area. And they could make the DRS work in conjunction with that underfloor as well. But they'd have to manage that airflow separation better than they currently are. They're managing it well at the moment in the high-speed corners because they don't really have it. So it's a sort of a circle of events, I think. They won't get something for nothing. I think taking the other example, obviously running it into Mercedes. Mercedes have got a little bit too much of that separation problem, and that's what's making the car so inconsistent and nervous in the rear end on high speed. You get nothing for nothing in a Formula One car. Everything is interrelated. Everything works hand in hand. So I think, both McLaren to get their DRS drag reduction that they want to be able to overtake people easier in a race, they need to think about the whole car. It's not just the, working on the DRS wing system. It's about how the whole interaction of the airflow structure around the back of the car happens when the DRS is closed and when the DRS is open.
Yeah, and the good thing is that does seem to be the way they're conceiving it, insofar as whenever Andrea Stella, the team principal, talks about it, he says it's basically another kind of one-year project to get there in terms of it's particularly the longer slow corners. Like the initial turn in for slow corner seems to be okay, and then the car starts to give up, as Stella puts it. And he sort of piled the DRS thing and the slow corner weaknesses as their sort of main things over that long period of time. So
yeah,
while that might sound slow, that's quite encouraging, isn't it? Because that at least suggests they understand it's a very complex thing to do, and they're thinking, right, we're going to have to just sort of chip away at this over the next 12 months of development to get to a point where we've got an all-round car. And obviously that means to the point where they have got a DRS effect in a slow corner, a long slow corner performance that's comparable to their prodigious fast corner performance.
Yeah, well, the thing about the getting the entry in the slow corners is you've got the weight transfer to play with, because obviously when you're going into a slow corner, you're slowing down. So the driver can play with that, how late he brakes into the corner, how he turns in on the brakes, how you use that weight transfer. But then once you've come off the brake pedal, you're just relying on front grip. That's obviously where the problem is, and that's where you have to get the grip from the downforce. So yes, I agree with this philosophy there for sure. And I also agree that it's not a 5-minute job to fix it. It's one of these sort of situations that the biggest thing with any problem is recognizing what the problem is, and then it's about instigating bits and pieces that will fix it. But you want to be very careful, because you can definitely hurt yourself as well. You can trip up over it pretty quickly. So it's better to take a bit of time knowing your problems and knowing the circuits that you should be good at, or the corners you should be good at as well. If you can recognise all that, then you can take the best out of the car you've got. And that's often quite good. That's often good enough to do a good job. It's whenever you don't recognise your problems and suddenly you get hit with a problem at a track that it's like, oh, what happened there? I don't understand that. That's the thing you don't want. And as I say, for them, it's better to take a little bit of time and come upon it slowly rather than react to it too quickly and then give himself another bigger headache somewhere else down the road.
And you mentioned Ferrari at the start there, and obviously where they're at is interesting, because it looks like they've got quite a good all-round car that it's quite easy to extract pace from at all three circuits so far. It seems reasonably well balanced. So it looks like they've got a car that is good across the board, a bit like the Red Bull in many ways in terms of a wide range of corner conditions and that kind of thing. And that's got to be pretty encouraging, because that means that if they can just develop there, just keep going forward, keep adding performance to it, if they can do it a little bit faster than Red Bull, that could be quite encouraging, couldn't it? I guess that's where you need to be, don't you? You need a car that's an all-rounder, not just overpowered in certain areas. And if you've got an all-round car and you can keep adding performance to it without hitting trouble, then you're going to be in pretty good shape on a long enough timeline.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a car that's pretty good everywhere, that sort of suits the average circuit, because the circuits aren't all the same. We get a good variety of them. So, you know, you want to be able to get the best out of it every weekend, as opposed to just one weekend being fantastic and the next weekend being, you know, and the also-rans. So it's better to be in that position and try to add a little bit of performance around the same aerodynamic characteristics, you know, just to exploit it a little bit further. Don't get too carried away with it all. But, you know, the reality of it is we've only had three races this year so far, so it's not too much. But, you know, if we look at these set of regulations are coming through from 2022, Ferrari were, you know, less than 0.1% slower than Red Bull over the whole season. In 23, they were 0.38% slower than Red Bull over the whole season. And so far this year, they're 0.23 slower than Red Bull over the whole season so far. So there's still ground to make up. But, you know, we have two situations. One is the car speed, which obviously comes into play on a Saturday afternoon. And one is its race durability for tyres, and that's a different deal altogether. It's better to have a fast car and then try and compromise that speed a little bit with getting the tyres to be, you know, less degradation on Sunday than have a slow car that's very good on its tyres, because you're always fighting the battle of getting past people. So the reality of it is, I think Ferrari have really got a reasonable balanced package between those two at the moment. That's what's doing them, giving them a decent run at this championship. They don't have the quickest car by any means, and they have a bit of ground to make up on Red Bull. But, you know, as I say, having a decent car on a Saturday as a decent car on a Sunday is better than a very good car on a Saturday and a bad car Sunday, or vice versa. So at the end of the day, you know, they've got something to work on, and the momentum's there. And as I say, Carlos Sainz has got the bit between his teeth as well now. So looking for a job's always a good thing to start dotting the I's and crossing the T's on your own ability. So, yeah, I think we'll see a good season. I think we're going to see something quite interesting. I think Suzuka might be quite an interesting weekend, I think, just for a bit of fun with those fast corners.
Well, that's the interesting one for McLaren, isn't it? Because we've got this, the way the calendar is, actually the first four races, each one gets progressively better for McLaren in terms of the strengths and weaknesses of its car. So yeah. Bahrain wasn't great at all. Saudi Arabia was better because it had plenty of fast stuff, but it's got those two long, slow corners at either end of the track. And then another step again, Australia. And then you've got Suzuka. And that's going to be really interesting, because obviously we also had Suzuka towards the back end of last year, by which time McLaren had made their big step forward. So Suzuka's almost the acid test for the progress that McLaren's taken. They were a clear best of the rest there last year. We know Ferrari have improved. So I'm really interested to see if McLaren can actually emerge as second best at Suzuka in the next race weekend, because that's one of the tracks that should play absolutely to the strengths of the car.
Yeah, I think they'll definitely be in the mix for it. I think they'll be viewing it with a lot of enthusiasm. You just got to go through the procedures now. They know they've got the drivers. They know they've got a car that's potentially in that mix for those top four places on the grid. And at the end of the day, you just got to execute the weekend correctly, because that's a very, very important thing. You know, no mistakes, no little sillies from the driver, you know, sliding off the road early on and, you know, just hurting the damage in the floor, the underfloor, all that sort of stuff. You just got to make sure you got the car there right at the time whenever you need to have it there, and it's not sort of a compromised car because of a little bit of damage here and there. So, you know, it's just about executing the weekend from a team point of view and from a driver point of view in the best way possible. And if that happens, then I think they can be in the mix at the front.
Yeah, that's something everybody will look forward to seeing. The more cars at the front, the better. Let's move on to our main topic now, because one of the big stories of the Australian Grand Prix was Williams only being able to field one car after Alex Albon tore a hole in one of its two monocoques with a crash on Friday. Of course, he was then given Logan Sargeant's monocoque for Saturday and Sunday, finishing 11th. What did you make of this situation, Gary? Ever been in a situation like that?
Yes, I have. Never really to the extent of, I suppose, a whole car as such. Been to that extent where you've had good bits that you had to move around from one car to another because of damage. But it's one of those sort of situations where, you know, this currently it's a different world. Formula One's a completely different place from how you go about managing it. The teams are now enormous, they're huge, and the facilities they have are huge. Even the smallest team is still enormous compared to, you know, my day whenever we had like 200, 250 people, which I thought at that point in time was crazy. But it's one of those difficult things. You have to make that decision sometimes, you know, of who gets the good parts or who gets the chassis if you have damaged the car. And, you know, I don't think the decision that they made was wrong. For sure, if you just take the past, then Alex Albon was the one that, if points were going to be on the cards, then he was the one that was going to probably bring him home. No disrespect to Logan Sargeant, you know, he hasn't shown his true potential yet, if he has got that potential to do that, whether it's because he's a slow learner or whether he's just not got the same, you know, the same level of car performance as Alex Albon has from his car. Who knows what the reasons are. At the end of the day, they've signed him up for 2024. They've got to see it through. And there is a compromise. The big problem is not to do with having to make that decision or any of that sort of stuff. It's the fact that they didn't have the spares there to actually, you know, rebuild the car if necessary. And what you got to remember is that, you know, they have been in a position where they've been using up bits quite quickly last year and into this year, you know. So they are in a position where, you know, their spare parts get used up pretty quickly. So they need to be on top of that to make sure they've got enough parts. And not having a spare chassis there, I've been in that position at the first race. And it's always a tricky one to, you know, you've got your fingers crossed a lot of the time just because you haven't had the opportunity to build a spare chassis. But it's a tough decision to make, but I think James Vowles made the right decision at the end of the day. They didn't get a point, but that's life, you know. It's about being competitive enough.
The timelines are fascinating on this because, well, originally, the original plan was that they would have a spare chassis, have the third monocoque for the first race of the season. And then they realised they wouldn't, and the plan was they'd hopefully have it for Australia, and then that slipped back further. Now, the chassis is obviously a very long lead time component, so they've known for a while they were going to be in trouble. James Vowles said they had to make some decisions about what they focused on, whether they prioritised the third chassis over, say, some other parts, etc. And even with this situation, that third chassis shouldn't be ready currently until China, which is the race after Suzuka. So they're set to go to the Japanese Grand Prix with a patched up version of the repaired chassis from Australia. So how do these production delays happen? And what happens when you're confronted with these trade-offs about what you prioritise? And you think, right, okay, well, we're either going to lose out in terms of development parts and performance or the fundamental parts, if you see what I mean, because obviously the chassis is absolutely fundamental. You cannot race without it.
Well, it's, you know, I'm that's where I start to disagree a little bit with what James Vowles is saying, because, you know, one of the things he's saying is about changing the processes, etc. Every process needs managed. Doesn't matter what it is. You know, going back through to early in my days, we're talking about a pencil and a piece of paper, but you still got a plan together and you monitored it. And it's about the monitoring. Every minute of every day, somebody needs to be monitoring that. Nowadays, it's not one person, it's probably 10 people that's monitoring it. So, you know, if you have a delay in getting a front wing made, you shouldn't be taking people off the chassis build to build a front wing for you, because at the end of the day, every part of the car has got its expertise, it's got its, you know, its requirement from a set of hands that knows what they're doing. There's a lot of man hours goes into all these composite componentry being assembled correctly. And that's very important. If you just swap people around all the time, you end up with not as good a product as you want. So I don't think it's in the process as much as the actual manpower they have. Somewhere along the line, they don't have the manpower to manage the build process required for a Formula One team. Now, you could either take that back a bit and you can say, well, if they hit the button on the first chassis build the beginning of October last year, then that they've scheduled themselves wrongly in the fact that, you know, they didn't give themselves enough time. You know, I'd say a chassis, from my point in time, you know, you were talking a month roughly to manufacture from the first day you started cutting carbon fibre. And, you know, so a month for each chassis, the same set of moulds work for the same chassis, so you need to make one chassis, then you make a second chassis, then you make a third chassis. Some teams will have sub-moulds to make parts of it. So, you know, lots and lots of ways you can do it. But it's all about managing that build schedule. You know how long it's going to take for each component on the car. You've got experience of it from the previous years. So all you got to do is make sure you start at the right time. And I'm sure that Williams' problem was they didn't start at the right time. They delayed the start of building the first chassis, or building signing off the first car, I suppose you might call it, or the first set of parts. They delayed that too long. Now, that's what teams have been working on for years now, is to reduce that time, because the more you can reduce the manufacturing time, the longer the design and development time you have. And so they're a team, in my book, that, you know, they're not structured well enough. Never mind the fact that it's a process change. It's about structuring it well enough to recognise how long it takes to make all the components. And then your process, as I say, it could be a pencil on a piece of paper, it could be an Excel sheet, or it could be some, you know, vastly expensive handwritten set of software that controls all the components. But it still needs input. It still needs input every day as to how things are going along. You know, if Joe Bloggs is sick on a Tuesday and he doesn't get that, you know, the front wing outer skin laid up, somebody else has to do it. Or you need to know by Tuesday lunchtime that that's late, because then you've got an opportunity to do it. But if Joe Bloggs doesn't show up till the next Friday because he's been off sick and nobody knew about it and nobody put it into the process, then you got a problem. So it's all about just managing the build program from start to finish. There's a huge amount of little parts in these cars. It's not all just the big parts. You don't look at a chassis and say, oh, that is a chassis. In the chassis itself, there's probably 1,000 different components, all the inserts and, you know, bits and pieces that have to go into it. So every part of the car has got to be managed correctly. But it doesn't matter what the processes you have. You still can manage it. As I say, even if it was a piece of paper and a pencil, you could manage it if it's managed and if you know how long it takes to make components. So I think they've slipped up there. They've taken too much time in the design stage of the car and left themselves with too little time to manufacture it.
Well, certainly James Vowles has been very frank about some of the weaknesses in Williams. They're obviously trying to make some big steps in this area. He said that one of the things that the teams lacked is an ERP system, an enterprise resource planning system, which is kind of a fully integrated way to track absolutely everything, all the several tens of thousands of parts that are being worked on at any given time, etc. So that's something they're investing in and they're working on putting into place. That costs a fair bit. And obviously this is a team that has had quite a long period of underinvestment that it's fighting back from. So do you think it's excusable for Williams to be in this situation? Obviously it shouldn't happen, but given there were many years of underinvestment they're trying to battle away at, is it better to say, right, do you know what, we're going to take a hit now and try and get everything working in place? It was likened to Dave Robson, the head of vehicle performance, said of these process changes, that it's a little bit like trying to change the wheel of your bicycle while riding it in terms of the challenge. But is it better that they take the pain in the short term and face some of these situations if they can get a year or two down the line and they've made more progress with the wider infrastructure? Do you think that's a fair trade-off?
Well, I don't think there has to be a trade-off. There has to be an increase in what you're trying to do. Well, if that's manpower, as I say, you know, there is no substitute for manpower when it comes to getting things made. You can have all the processes in the world telling you that it needs to be ready by next Friday. But if you don't have the manpower there to actually get it ready by next Friday, then it's not going to happen. So I don't know how you sort of stop and stand still for a minute or two and say, okay, hang on, we're not quite ready yet, so let's change, you know, how we do things, and then suddenly everything will be okay. I think you have to learn from every day and put changes in place that will mean that you don't suffer these consequences ever again. We did see, I don't know when it was, a few years ago, when Williams didn't make the first test, and everybody said, oh, it was, you know, it's really bad. They're not there. You know, they didn't make a first test. They haven't got the mileage. It's really bad that they can't get these things sorted out. So it's not an unknown problem for Williams. So it's one of those sort of things. You know, as I say, every day you should be identifying your given set of problems that you have within the team, no matter whether it's manufacturing or processes or your the wheel changes, the pit stop strategy, the whole thing needs to be monitored, and then you try to better it as you go along. And that's exactly the same with building the car. You've got to try and make it more efficient every time. Every time you do it, you've got to look at the efficiency of it. So I think that they might be spending their time looking at this magic bullet that makes everything happen easier. It's not like that. You know, Red Bull or Mercedes or any other team, they still have a fight in their hands to make it, to get the car ready in time. It's not a case of, you know, it's easy for us because we're better organised. They still push the limits. You know, if there's an extra day available to do some more wind tunnel tests before you manufacture that underfloor, Red Bull will still be pushing to do that because that's what you need to do to be competitive. You can't just say, oh, well, we won't bother using that extra day. We'll just make it a day early so the new underfloor can sit in the workshop for a day. That's not the way it works.
The other interesting question about this is how you go about doing these repair jobs. And obviously, teams do have a certain capacity to do some repairs to carbon fibre at the track. They couldn't do that in this situation. I did ask James Vowles. He did a little media session on the Saturday morning to explain things. So I asked him just to run through the damage. And he said, well, gearbox cracked in two, engine mounts bent, the engine destroyed. The chassis side, the front right corner where the suspension goes in, is torn apart. That's the best way he could come up with to describe it. You can basically sort of put your finger into the chassis. So they looked at it, said they can't do it, and they were going to ship it back. And Monday, 2 a.m., they were expecting to have that chassis back at Williams for the fast turnaround job to get it patched up, ideally as good as new, to ship to Suzuka. Now, what happens in terms of that repair process? If you're there at 2 a.m., you're part of the team that's receiving that monocoque. What do you do to then fully assess the damage? Because obviously they'll have seen photos, they'll have done the preliminary assessment, but once you physically got it, there's more information there. What's that process? How do you go about it?
Well, the first thing really is you'd probably work from the photographs you see. So it wouldn't just, the work just wouldn't start when the chassis arrived there. You just make sure, first of all, you've got some sub-molds for the areas that are damaged, because, you know, the whole thing won't go into a mold again. So you'll need to get yourself some sub-molds underway, I suppose you might call it.
So sub-molds are sort of the small sections of it, yeah?
A small section of the chassis where it's damaged that, just to a level that you can sort of replace that part of the chassis. Everything you're going to do to the chassis will obviously add weight, because there's no way you can make it just as good as it is. So when the chassis arrives, the first thing is you'll start cutting back the damaged parts, trying to find a decent structural material. So these chassis are made up. There's inserts for the suspension, for example, machined out of aluminium or titanium or even carbon. But there's an outer skin. There's in the honeycomb core, and then there's an inner skin. So what you would do is you start to cut back till you get to carbon that's not cracked, damaged, torn apart, whatever you like to call it. And then once you get the outer skin to a point where you're happy that it's, you know, you've got a good structure there, then you'll take the core away for another, you know, 25 millimetres or something around that size of the hole you have in the outer skin. And you'll take the inner skin away and maybe another 25 millimetres around that area, or, you know, roughly. So you can basically put the sub-mould on the chassis. You can lay up that as such new inner skin with the overlap onto the old inner skin. Then you can put in the new honeycomb, which will be machined differently to make everything you know, flat again, and then you'll patch up the inner skin on that. So you'll repair it, and you'll have, as I say, a sort of 25-30 millimetre overlap where you can to transmit the load from the new part to the old part. You will use, you know, lower temperature materials there because you don't want to put the chassis into an oven and damage the chassis that's there. So you know, everything is possible, but it will add weight to that chassis. Will it be as good as before? Yes, it will be. We've repaired many, many chassis. I mean, I'll go back to 91 in Adelaide with De Cesaris and Zanardi. And, you know, Zanardi was quick, but he was a bit ruthless. He went off and damaged the two bottom nose fixings on the chassis, basically pulled them out of the chassis. We had a spare chassis there, so for the next day we took the spare chassis, got it built up for the next day, and away he went again, and he did exactly the same thing. But this time he took three of the nose fixings off the front of the chassis. So we, you know, on the Saturday night, I think it was, we got out the spare chassis with the two nose fixings damaged, rebuilt them as best we could. Into the chassis because it was less damaged than the one he had damaged on the Saturday. And then by the Sunday, he was back in the original car with a big repair done to it. But as I say, it's all about adding weight to try and put the thing all back together again. So you can do it. I think the day that Alex Albon gets a new chassis will be the day he goes, oh, well, that feels better. It's no different whatsoever, but it'll feel better just because it will be probably 2 or 3 kilos lighter. In his mind, it will be a new chassis constructed from start to finish. So, everything's fixable, but there is a price to pay.
And there is, of course, the question of, does the repaired chassis go back to Alex Albon or does it go to Logan Sargeant? Because you obviously want to back your best driver. Potentially they may choose to give him the good chassis and bad chassis perhaps isn't the way to put it, but as you say, there is a little bit of weight. What about the question of, because obviously the damage is around where the suspension pickup points are, and sometimes you hear talk about a soft suspension pickup point and that kind of thing, and a bit of flex and so on and so forth. So you sound pretty confident that it can be repaired properly, but is there a risk something might not be quite right? And how easy is it to test everything to make sure you haven't got a little bit of movement? Because obviously, if there is even a tiny bit of movement around suspension points, that can influence the geometry and can actually have quite a nasty little effect, can't it?
Yes, it can. And yeah, there is always a risk. So there are no guarantees that you can fix it properly. However, you know, you'd need to look at the chassis in minute detail to make sure that you've got a fair understanding, and it will be better to add a couple of extra kilograms of weight into the chassis to make sure that you fixed it structurally as best you can. So if it needs to have that a little bit extra, then don't worry about it, just get on with it. So it's one of those sort of situations. I say I haven't seen the detail, but whatever you said about the engine mountings being twisted, and you know, they are a machine component that's set in between the skins of the carbon fibre. If they're twisted, you know, that means that the carbon fibre has failed in that area. So that's quite a big task, because it's the, you know, these cars with the vertical G, lateral G, that's the middle of the car. That's where you get all the bending going on. That's where the CAG is, around that sort of area. So you've got the maximum bending in the engine mounts, and that's something that can change a car dramatically. Never mind a wishbone pickup moving tenth of a millimetre or half a millimetre. If there's a little bit of flex in the engine mount area, and something that I used to push for dramatically was the stiffness of that. You know, the stiffness of the front of the engine was really as important as the stiffness of the back of the chassis, because it, you know, and some engine manufacturers, and we had a lot of them through our time, you know, the only thing they cared about was putting four engine mounts in front of the chassis. It didn't really matter about how stiff they were. As far as they were concerned, it was fine, because the engine would bolt onto the chassis. But, you know, we used to do the vertical and lateral stiffness tests on it to see, which I'm sure Williams will do this time now, you know, and you load the chassis up, you put a vertical load into it and a bending load into it, and just make sure the car isn't bending in the middle, because that's one of the biggest problems with these cars. If that's happening, then to get rid of that is quite a tricky manoeuvre.
And just in terms of how it feels to be in this situation, what would you be thinking if you were heading to Suzuka knowing you didn't have a spare chassis. Obviously, Suzuka's not the most forgiving circuit if you go off in it. So you'd be pretty nervous, wouldn't you? And I imagine you'd have to... Would you make it clear to the drivers, look, please don't crash? Or do you just have to think, well, they're racing drivers. Every now and again, things will go wrong and they will both be aware of what the consequences will be?
Well, it's a bit of both. I think you go there feeling pretty nervous of something happening. You make sure that when you go in there, you pack a little bit of an extra repair kit, perhaps, a little bit extra carbon and a little bit more resin than you would normally take, because you know that, you know, if you do it this time, you're probably going to have to do a running repair. And the drivers just need to take care. You know, that's all you can ask for them is, you know, don't drive differently from what you would drive normally, but just corners where you can have a big accident and have consequences. You know, give it a little bit. Just give it that tenth of a second for now. When it comes to qualifying, yeah, okay, you can use that bit up. But just, you know, don't do it every lap. It doesn't matter. It's not really that important. So just find your feet, make sure the car's a decent balance, the car feels decent to you. And then whenever you push comes to shove for qualifying, try and find that little bit extra time. And if it all goes wrong, well, then, you know, so be it. That's what racing drivers are. But a lot of the times, whenever you're trying to not make something happen, that's when it does go wrong, because you're driving differently, I suppose you might call it. So there'll be a few words, I think, in the pre-briefing for Suzuka for their two drivers as to what happens. But it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds. I hope they have a good weekend. I hope they have everything goes to plan, and both of them qualify decently, and both of them race decently, and both of them see the checkered flag, because that would be, you know, that'd be a nice set of circumstances for them. They need something. They've had a hard time.
Yeah, exactly. And they just need a clean weekend, simply because that accident in Australia will have set back their upgrade plan a little bit. Their upgrade plan was already set back from the other problems they'd had. So they've got performance to put on this car that is being constantly put back. And of course, the more that performance is put back, the less valuable it will be, because everybody is going to be taking steps forward. So yeah, tough start to the season for Williams. And yeah, let's hope Suzuka is a straightforward weekend for them. Well, the Race F1 Tech Show wouldn't be half as much fun without the contributions made by our listeners. And that always means the question and answer section of this podcast is our favourite. As always, I'd like to encourage everyone who has a question to send it in, because I can guarantee that even if you think it's a stupid question, it absolutely will not be. Sometimes the simplest questions are not the most fascinating answers. So if you have anything at all you'd like to put to Gary, email it to podcasts@therace.com, either in written form or as a voice note recorded on your phone. And if you go with that recorded option, remember to include your name. The first question today, Gary, is from Paul Tilley, who says, how much leeway do the teams have in the gearbox setup, and how different are the teams in those choices? In listening to some of the cars, it sounds like eighth gear is a slight overdrive, but other cars sound like the final drive is kept to 1-to-1. Are my ears correct? What are the advantages or disadvantages of each approach in F1, and do these vary track to track? And if so, how?
Well, each team nominates the set of gears that they have for the season. So obviously what you look at is the engines do, I think it's 15,000 RPM now the rev limiter is set at. So fastest track you've got is Monza. So your eighth gear needs to be approaching 15,000 RPM at Monza for the drag of your car. The lower gears are not such a drama with these cars, because you do have the electrical torque. So you will hear quite a lot of different gears being used by different drivers. If the rear is getting away from you a little bit out of a corner, the driver will shift up earlier. So it's just one of those things where you can control the torque quicker, i.e. like traction control, if you do shift up and the revs are then lower. So in theory, every car should have a very similar top speed, so a very similar eighth gear. It will be that some drivers will use that eighth gear quicker or earlier than others. So you will hear a bit of a difference between what the driver wants to do with the car. But engine RPM relative to the car speed, which obviously is eighth gear, then they will all be very, very similar, because you can't do much about that. If you expect your car to do 300 kilometres, let's say, at Monza, maximum speed, then you'd have a very different eighth gear from a car that they were going to expect to do 350 kilometres at Monza. So, yeah, you know, it's one of those things. You nominate your gears at the beginning of the season. That's your eight gears that you use. And, again, as I say, then it's up to the driver to, A, change earlier, save fuel, use it as, you know, a bit of traction control because you can cut the power pretty quickly. So, there is a different approach. You can hear it differently, but it really, at the end of the day, isn't a massive difference from car to car or team to team.
And I guess while you've only got eight gear ratios for the season, the fact these engines have a reasonably wide torque band, I guess, makes it not too difficult a challenge to work those out.
Yeah, back in the old days when you had the high rev and high pitched cars, you were changing gears, you know, just for a 50 RPM difference because you had such a small window of torque. And, we used to have, at times, we would have, you know, 100 different gears. And really, interestingly, that was ridiculous, but it was the way it evolved. Now, this is a good solution. The gears are a bit beefier than they used to be, and you've got to nominate your eight gears at the beginning of the season, and away you go. And it's up to you. And as I say, the cars, you know, you could go from Monaco to Monza. You could have the same eight gears in the car, and you wouldn't know the difference because you just use them slightly differently. And because the car's got a fairly wide torque curve, and you've got electrical assistance on top of all that, you know, you can, it's the same for everybody, I suppose. That's what you call it, just the same for everybody. Why not do it?
The next question comes from Andrew Moore, who says, if F1 had introduced something like DRS back in the late V10 era, say 1999 to 2005, do you think that it would have improved the raceability of the cars? I'm not a fan of DRS in general, but I would have loved to see if it would have changed our views on racing back in the day. I also wonder, if it was successful back then what do you think it would have meant for the regulations since then? Maybe the change in 2009 was not necessary and the cars may have gone in a different direction for modern regs, and maybe they would have the DRS switch off as soon as the cars are side by side. I think that's how it should be.
I don't disagree with you. I'd love to see them run a race where the DRS is available to you until you get within 1 second of the car in front of you, because I think if you can keep the field closed up, you have a slightly different dynamic. You know, you can't afford to just break that DRS, knowing that if you've done that, then there's no chance of somebody overtaking you. Now, it is a difficult thing because the closer you are to the car in front of you, you know, if you're within 2 seconds of the car in front of you, you will get turbulence. Your car will be affected. It will start to overheat, or it will start to heat up more, let's say. And the tyres will degrade faster. So it's never a good thing to be up close behind all the rest of the cars. But then that's a choice. You know, if you allow them to use DRS to keep the field close together, then it's the choice of the driver to have a go overtaking somebody as quickly as possible. I don't like DRS either because I think it's, you know, takes away from the driver's talent. But maybe the Formula does need it. Going back to 1990, 2005, you know, it was a different formula then, to be honest. You know, we had all the refueling and the different tyres and, you know, lots and lots of mixes in there. I was never a fan, really, of the race being won in the pit lane. I like racing to be racing. So, you know, refueling led to the fact that, depending upon the strategy that you used, you know, the pit lane was where most of the action could happen. We still see it to some extent with when the pit stops happen. But now it seems to be a bit more of a, you know, I'll copy whatever you do situation. So at the minute, we seem to need DRS. And because we've got a one-make formula, everybody's on the same tyre more or less at the same time. So I'm not sure what it would have done way back then. I think, again, it's just like anything. It's one of those sort of things. Unless you actually experiment with it, you would never know what it would have done to the racing, because it's just different.
Yeah, unintended consequences can often arise from this sort of thing. But yeah, it's interesting to consider it, because some of the more famous races from the refueling era, say Michael Schumacher's four-stopper when he beat Alonso at Manicourt, I would think if you had a DRS system, that wouldn't happen, because the reason that happened was the Ferrari was fundamentally quicker over a race stint, but the Bridgestones didn't fire up as quickly. So he qualified behind and around, particularly on outlaps and that kind of thing, the Renault was quicker. So they did the four stops in order to find some clear air and make use of that pace. So that sort of scenario, I think, with DRS might not happen. You may have just had Schumacher let the tyres bed in for a bit, get to the second half of the first stint, and he could have DRS passed, and then it would be a race nobody ever talks about now. So it's interesting to think how that would have influenced things, and it could actually have been a bigger negative in that you wouldn't have had those sort of memorable races, or like the Imola races with Schumacher and Alonso as well, where there wasn't passing. So yeah, it's an interesting question about what makes good racing, isn't it? Because it's not necessarily straightforward overtaking.
No, it's not straightforward overtaking. It's you know, racing is about getting from when the lights go out to the checkered flag in the minimum amount of time possible, no matter where you are on the grid as such. And, you know, it can be done in many ways. And that's why the multi-stop races before, you know, sometimes beat the less stop races or the different tyres used. I mean, you know, we had a lot of things in Australia about tyres graining. In the Bridgestone days, I mean, the tyre graining, you know, tracks like Barcelona, it was normal. It just the tyres used to grain like crazy. But you'd get three laps, four laps of it. And if you were a driver that respected that tyre graining, you could drive through it. The tyre would clean up again, and away you go for another 15 laps. So it's, you know, there's always something going on that the driver has to contribute to. And the DRS is a bit like that. At the moment, we've seen the double DRS, where you've got a hairpin between two usages of DRS. So one driver will be clever enough to not quite overtake, but nearly overtake, meaning they can make a better overtake on the next part of the DRS. So it's just, you know, it's all sorts of things. But I think you can't just go backwards and say what would have happened if, because we could go, you know, we could go on forever. You could go backwards and say, well, what would have happened if we only had 9 points for a win and points down to sixth? We could go on with those sort of seasons. Who would have won the last year's championship with that? You know, set a point structure, and how much would they have won it by? And so there's things change on the way, and you end up, you know, I think you have to just judge them for the set of regulations that we have. At the moment, it seems impossible that two cars could overtake each other without the use of DRS, or very, very difficult for two cars to overtake each other without the use of DRS. So it's there, it's part of the racing. I don't like it because I think it means that the DRS, you know, is just something that the drivers sit and wait on and make sure that they make the best use of when they can use it. But it has become part of car design. And I was saying, you know, earlier on with the McLaren and its DRS, it has become an integral part of car design now. It's not just a bit of a drag reduction during the race to help you sort of overtake another car. It's now a completely intricate part of the car. And, it's different, but I'm not a DRS fan, as you might hear, right, recognise from this. But I think there's other solutions to using it differently that might be better. But how it would work back in the late 90s, early 2000s, really difficult to sort of assess it.
Next question from Dan Kay. This is talking about the discussion point on the last podcast episode about the Mercedes struggles. And Dan Kay says, Gary, you've mentioned multiple times since 2022 that it's possible Mercedes either don't fully understand the new aerodynamic regulations and their simulation tools are giving them wrong information. This was also hinted at by Ed and Mark Hughes in the Saudi Arabia post-race podcast. How would you tackle this? Will this cause development to stand still and potentially use up the limited CFD and wind tunnel budget? Also, have you found yourself in a similar position in F1?
Many times I found myself in a similar position. It's one of these things I keep saying. Unless you recognise the problem, you can't fix it. And, you know, sometimes you have to stand back for a little while till you get your head around why it could be happening. It's always difficult to understand how another team, another racing group of people can actually beat you consistently, because you've all got the same sort of, you know, tools, talent, money, budget, especially nowadays, and especially with the cost cap. So you know, you're getting beaten by the same set of tools that somebody else could have. So you know, the only thing you can do is you have to think laterally. And I think what the one thing that Mercedes have lost themselves in a little bit is the fact that these cars are very, very complicated when it comes to the airflow structure. And it's one of these things where I think Australia showed it quite well that, you know, at FP3, Lewis was very happy with his car. You know, 2 hours later in qualifying, the car was terrible. So the car is too critical. It's just quite simply too critical to be consistent enough to get any sort of feeling from a driver point of view about how hard you can push. And that comes from just what they're trying to do. We've always heard Mercedes saying that their car should be a second quicker than anybody else if they could just get it into the sweet spot. How they know that or how they sort of think they can achieve that, I have no idea. Because it's one of those sort of situations that, you know, you've got to learn by what's happening in front of you. You've got to look at what's happening in front of you, and you've got to see the fact that what they've been trying to do with their car, no matter what the configuration of the car visually is, it's inconsistent. Lewis doesn't like the rear end the way the car is. I mean, it's a driver that will drive the car with the car being oversteery, let's say. He doesn't mind an oversteery balance, but he wants a balance. He wants to know what the car's going to do, and that's what he hasn't got at the moment. So I think they've missed the boat somewhere along the line with how the underfloor is functioning and how to manage the airflow separation. Because when you have a vehicle like that that's producing the downforce is from the underfloor, you will always have some airflow separation. And as I say in my articles, my columns and all that, I keep writing about the dimmer switch. You know, it needs to work like a dimmer switch. It can't be an on-off switch. If you've got an on-off switch, you've got a Mercedes. If you've got a dimmer switch, you've probably got now, you know, a Red Bull, a Ferrari, and a McLaren. So it's one of those sort of situations where you've got to recognise how to make that dimmer switch work. And it isn't easy. I'm sitting here saying this is their problem. It is their problem, but you've got to get your guys to go off and try to recognise how to make that dimmer switch work well. If you don't, you know, if you don't instruct your guys of what the objective is, you can easily be lost for a long, long time. So it's not, you know, it's not how you use the CFD. It's not how you use the wind tunnel. It's not how you use the simulation tools. It's about what you generate as a car. You know, you can't put the information into the simulation that you don't have. So all the information you're gathering from CFD and wind tunnel, you put into the simulator. And some of that you got to extrapolate from other data that you gather. You can't gather all the data that needs. So somewhere along the line, they're not sort of putting that package together that allows them to understand the car and make a car that's got more consistency.
Yeah, exactly. When it comes to that thing of correlation, it's not just about is your hardware giving you accurate numbers, it's are you using those numbers in the correct way, which feeds into what you're talking about there. So yeah, it's a complicated thing. There's a question now from David Patterson on a similar topic, who says, with Mercedes effectively restarting the design of their car after the failed Zero Pod concept, how does their pace over the first three races this season compare to the equivalent pace over the first three races against the rest of the field when the new ground effect rules came in? And where would they find themselves in that pecking order had they started with this concept then? Does this indicate that they are effectively 3 years behind on the evolution of the car? And do they have the expertise to fix this but are under pressure to fix it quickly given the head start the other teams have?
Well, David, I haven't looked deeply at just the three races from 2022 or 2023, but obviously we've only had three races of 2024. But I can compare it to those two seasons, as such, I suppose you might call it. Now, if we take Red Bull as the example, they, as a you know, taking the fastest lap every weekend of the fastest Red Bull driver, I suppose you might call it, i.e. Max Verstappen on most occasions, you know, you end up with being able to take all of those races and find a percentage that they are off being perfect. If you were fastest every weekend, you would be at 0%, or if you like to call it 100%. But nobody has ever just exactly as black and white as that. But if we take 2022, Red Bull were again over the season average the fastest car, so they had the 0% as such. And what we had with Mercedes over the 2022 season was they end up 0.7% slower than Red Bull. If you take 2023, again, it was Red Bull who were fastest over the whole season. And if we take their deficit, Mercedes deficit, it was 0.72% off Red Bull. And if we take 2024, the first three races for, obviously, for again, Red Bull are the fastest over the three weekends. It was a Ferrari in Bahrain that was on pole and did the fastest lap, but the next two races were Red Bull. So Red Bull are the fastest on average over those three races. And Mercedes are 0.79% off Red Bull. So as far as Red Bull are concerned, they were consistently the fastest car. And as far as Mercedes are concerned, they were 0.71% in 2022, 0.72% in 2023, and they're now 0.79% in 2024. So they really haven't gone anywhere. That's the big problem. And it's the others now that make the difference, because at the moment, others like Aston Martin, in 2024, Aston Martin and McLaren have jumped ahead of them from the beginning. Ferrari were always ahead of them. But again, you know, Ferrari are not quite as good as Red Bull. But Ferrari were always ahead of Mercedes. And now, as I say, McLaren and Aston Martin have jumped ahead of Mercedes. So it's one of those sort of situations where over these 3 years of racing so far, from the statistics that we can look at, Mercedes have not closed the gap down on Red Bull. They've stood still with Red Bull as such, but they haven't closed the gap down. So, and that's the important thing. It's all relative. You know, you've got an objective. There's a guy at the front, and you want to, the most important thing is close down on them. If you're standing still, then you're doing okay. You're doing a good job, but they're relatively, others are doing a better job because they've leapfrogged in front of you. So I'm not sure that if they'd had different side pod structures at the beginning, whether that would have improved their performance, because as I say, they've been so consistently offset. I think from my point of view, the biggest thing that Mercedes have got is the inconsistency. It is every weekend's a new experience for them. And to be honest, every practice session's a new experience for them. So it's one of these sort of situations. I think they need to try and eliminate that first, because the most important thing is you get into a routine of where you know you are and how the car works, and then you can develop it from there. And it's very difficult if every weekend's a new experience.
And it's a contrast to what we talked about earlier with Ferrari having a car that works pretty well across a broad range of conditions. You can work with that, you can go forward with it, whereas Mercedes keeps bouncing around. Just for comparison of relative pace, the car's obviously a chunk quicker than it was a couple of years ago. Now you have to be careful about conditions change, the tires change, sometimes the tire allocations change as well, but the car in terms of their fastest qualifying laps was just under 2 seconds quicker in Bahrain and Australia than it was in 2022, just 0.8 quicker in Saudi than it was in 2022, although of course the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix it was at the start of the season. Yeah, and in Saudi Arabia, it was just 0.8 seconds quicker. So the car's improving. Everyone's improving. But yeah, as Gary alluded to, it's all a relative game. But I just thought it might be useful just to underscore that the car has got better.
Yeah,
it's always a moving target.
Yeah, the fastest cars are getting faster every weekend, every year. The big thing that we always hear is, you know, that the cars, you know, a year's development is like 2 seconds in time. So if you start in Bahrain and go back to Bahrain with the same type of atmospheric conditions or whatever, you would be 2 seconds quicker at the end of the season than you were at the beginning of the season. I classify that as rubbish. That's a huge amount. I mean, from year to year, including a season's development plus building a new car, you might find a second. And I'm doing that now this year. We'll see it later on what it averages out at. But it's just the improvement over last year and over the year before. So it's interesting to see the steps, because, you know, when you're at the front, i.e. as Red Bull are, it is a diminishing return, I suppose you might call it. Red Bull would have to do much more dramatic stuff to the car to find big chunks of lap time. They're going to be finding the odd tenth, maybe. Whereas the others that were behind Red Bull over the last 2 years can find some bigger chunks of lap time. But it's all relative. Every weekend is relative to whoever's fastest. It doesn't matter what the lap time is. It doesn't matter if a chicane's change or a curb's higher or a curb's lower. You're only trying to beat the opposition on a given day. And that's the objective of racing, and it's a tough one. I'd pat Mercedes on the back for staying consistently over 3 years behind Red Bull, but I wouldn't pat them in the back because they're Mercedes. I'd pat them in the back if they were, I don't know, Haas, or they were, Williams, because they would have done a good job to have developed consistently behind the leading car. But as Mercedes, they should be up there with the leading car. So if they've got a deficit in 2022, the objective would be to make that deficit smaller by 2024, and they haven't. So they don't deserve the pat on the back. A smaller team would deserve that pat on the back, but not Mercedes.
Well, as team principal Toto Wolff was saying after the Grand Prix in Australia, we have a physics problem, and they've had that for a while. Well, thanks to Paul, Andrew, Dan and David for your questions. And remember, if you've got a question for Gary, you can send it to podcasts@therace.com. That's podcasts@the-race.com. And we'll do our best to answer it. That's all we've got time for on this episode, but we will be back after the Japanese Grand Prix in 2 weeks. So join us then for more from Gary.
The Athletic.